and Dire Tune of Ethiopia outkicked Russia's Alevtina Bikhtimirova by 2 seconds in the closest finish in the history of the women's race. San Antonio guard Manu Ginobili is the winner of the NBA Sixth Man Award. The veteran guard was a runaway winner, named first on 123 of 124 ballots cast. Carlos Zambrano is hoping to build on an impressive all-around performance and continue his strong play at Wrigley Field tonight when the Cubs open a two-game set against the New York Mets. The Cubs are coming off a three-game sweep of Pittsburgh and have won their last 11 of 14 contests. Adam Wainwright is looking to beat the Milwaukee Brewers for the second time in 6 days when the St. Louis Cardinals open a two-game series tonight at Miller Park. The U.S. women's basketball team has improved to 2-1 in the Good Luck Beijing tournament with a 92-56 romp over South Korea. The American squad closes out preliminary play with games against New Zealand on Wednesday and China on Thursday. And Danica Patrick is the first female winner in IndyCar history. She captured the Indy Japan 300 in her 50th career start. That's sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, celebrating young talent in classical music with the debut artist concert on April 27th. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
Illinois' budget problems have started to affect the University of Illinois Extension, a wide network of public educators teaching everything from health and gardening to science and technology. Last year, lawmakers promised the system $18 million in funding, but because of the state's huge deficit, that money has been held back. Mike Ray reports.
To give you an example of what UI Extension does, I drove to the West Englewood neighborhood on Chicago's south side. There's a middle school there called Vernon Johns Community Academy, and today, a group of sixth graders is dissecting rats.
Now, here you find the heart, and here are the lungs, okay?
The library at Vernon Johns has been transformed into a hands-on science lab.
Is that formaldehyde that I'm smelling?
Yes, there is formaldehyde. The formaldehyde is used to preserve the rats.
That's Dr. Oyewale Ajifolokun. Everyone calls him Dr. Oyi. He's a vet by profession, but he also teaches these kinds of classes through UI Extension. Dr. Oyi says the point is to encourage kids to pursue careers in medicine or science. Athena Hardin works in the library of Vernon Johns. She's in charge of bringing people like Dr. Oyi into the school. She says his classes have opened up possibilities in the minds of the students. Hardin says losing this kind of learning is going to have an impact.
It's very useful for our children. A lot of our children would not get this experience if there wasn't a University of Illinois Extension. And it will hurt our community.
It's just devastating.
That's Willeen Buffett, director of UI Extension's Cook County unit. In her 15 years with the program, she says the situation's never been this bad. Buffett says the office normally gets a check from the state around November. They're still waiting. But because things are looking so dire, she's already laid off 25 support staffers. That's out of a total of about 150 employees. Buffett says she's working on a new budget for the first of next month when, if the office doesn't get its funds, she'll have to lay off another 96 workers.
You must be scrambling right now to figure out how you're going to pay all these people.
Yes, I am. And pay rent and pay travel, because we have our educators are continuing operating. They are continuing with their workshops and their programs with our schools, with our park districts. Everyone is trying to live up to their job.
And it's not just in Cook County where there could be cuts. UI Extension as a whole is looking at about 450 layoffs throughout the state. A call to Governor Rod Blagojevich's office didn't produce many answers. His director of management and budget, Ginger Ostro, says the state is running a $750 million deficit this year.
Recognizing that, we've had to really slow our spending because we simply don't have the revenues coming in that were anticipated back in August when the budget was passed.
Lawmakers have been expressing frustration about the situation for the past week, but unless something is done soon, there won't be programs left to vent about. I'm Mike Ree.
Making sure a community has plenty of water can be a challenge. Often it involves preparing for the worst, such as a severe drought. But being prepared can be costly. In the first part of our series this week on Central Illinois water issues, Sean Crawford looks at how much is enough.
For most individuals, water is as close as turning on a faucet. Whether drinking it, using it to wash dishes, do laundry, or to bathe, our lives are dependent on water, and yet many cities walk a perilous line when it comes to their supply. It's a problem that surfaces more during hot and dry weather. Welcome to Lake Decatur. Built in 1922, the lake provides water for Decatur residents and a few other neighboring towns. But last summer, during a drought, lake levels dipped so low, Decatur city officials decided it was time to take action. They put restrictions on water use. Decatur Mayor Paul Osborne admits it was an unpopular move.
You get complaints that, you know, you can conserve water. You mean I can't water my lawn? It's like, that's the, you know, my lawn's going to die if I don't water it. And it's, can't wash my car. Car is really dirty. And so there's not this conservation conscious public in many cases. A lot of the complaints were just like that. And people, you know, recoil at that.
The situation came at the same time Decatur was actively looking at a second water source. There's a growing need for water, especially among industry, like Archer Daniels Midland, Caterpillar, and Tate & Lyle. Mayor Osborne says to maintain the jobs from those plants, Decatur must look ahead and make sure its water supply is sufficient. The city purchased a small lake nearby, but it's also studying the creation of a larger body of water. There's a hitch, however, the price tag. Possibly up to $50 million to build another lake. While discussions are still ongoing, Osborne says the thought of higher water bills has a lot of residents questioning whether the project is worthwhile.
I think most of the objections in the future, if that's the decision that we will make, will be from people that just don't want to pay for it through their water rates. You know, as long as you can turn your spigot on, you have water, you're not paying much for it, then why should we increase that? We probably don't even need another lake. I think there's an aspect of this, too, that people really need to understand. We had a mild drought this summer, and not nearly as serious as it could have been. And we had our industries and others conserving water. If that drought would have been extended, ADM and our major employers would have been sending people home or laying people off.
Osborne says it's possible ADM could help cover part of the cost of building another lake. That would lessen the blow to ratepayers. Decatur already gets some help from ADM to pay for another water supply project, the dredging of Lake Decatur.
The controls here beside her, this lever here, when she pushed that button down like that, that would allow that.
Joe Niehiser is the lake foreman in Decatur. Like he's showing off an expensive investment. A blue and white boat nicknamed the Commodore, which has rotors at the front end churning up sediment from the lake floor. Most of this was once topsoil that's eroded and found itself a new home underwater. As the sediment accumulates, less water can be stored in the lake. That's a problem. It means the supply of water available to the city is smaller. Dredging can help, according to Niehiser, but it's expensive. Niehiser says in previous dredging work, portions of the lake have seen capacity increase as much as 6%. That might not sound like a lot, but he says every bit helps. The sediment is brought up from the bottom of the lake, sent through a pipe traveling more than 2 miles, where it's dumped. Before this most recent round of dredging is completed, Niehiser expects it will amount to more than 150,000 semi-truckloads. In other words, Decatur has found itself in the dirt business.
We give it away right now to individuals that want it. Within a certain mile radius of our property, we will deliver it. However, they are doing a study to determine on the use.
Niehiser says the dirt has done well in field trials for agricultural use and could be marketed to farmers. No matter what happens, he says increasing lake capacity is worth any additional work getting rid of the sediment. Over in Springfield, where there's been talk for decades about a second lake, the city has still yet to act on that plan. And there are plenty who say Lake Springfield, the town's water source, is sufficient. Don Hanrahan says with a few changes, Springfield would be fine when it comes to the quantity of available water.
The city has never actually tried water conservation. They use an old-fashioned rate structure that rewards waste instead of penalizing it. So we don't really even know that we need any water supply.
Hanrahan is an opponent to building a second water source dubbed Hunter Lake. He's concerned about the environmental damage that would be done during construction. He says if the city wants to have an insurance policy for water, there are gravel pits outside of the town that hold enough to help Springfield in the case of a severe drought. The conditions Springfield, Decatur, and other central Illinois communities experienced last year caused problems with the water supply, but it was far from a worst-case scenario. Illinois has seen more extended drought periods in previous decades. The early 1950s stand out as one of the most severe. As lakes dried up, some water users were asked to curtail baths, showers, and even limit flushing of toilets. Vern Knapp is a hydrologist with the Illinois State Water Survey.
Droughts don't announce themselves at the beginning. Also, at the end, they don't predict themselves to say, okay, I'm going to quit. You get down to the end of the drought period and the rain hasn't come to replenish the reservoir, people are going to be worried quite a bit. We could have a drought situation come on that is worse than anything we've had.
As the drought of the 50s subsided, towns like Springfield and Decatur began talking about additional water. Springfield Mayor Tim Davlin says the plan has languished on the desks of mayors and aldermen for years.
I think I was in high school, maybe it was grade school, when it was first talked about. So, you know, it's been in the planning stage for a long time, and now it's up to governmental agencies.
That includes the U.S. EPA, which must grant a construction permit. So far, that's yet to happen. But Davlin says despite the obstacles, it's too important to keep putting off dealing with the issue.
Electricity, you can go and you can buy from the grid. We can end up getting power hooked in here made from California, from Nebraska, but you can't bring water in. I mean, that's a source that is, you know, our most valuable resource that we have. And so it's the reason why I think we've talked so much, so long about it, is because it is that important. You just can't ship water in.
Springfield's decision when it comes to water affects not only its residents, but those in other towns who purchase water from the capital city. But soon, some communities will stop buying from Springfield. They include Chatham, which is going to tap into an aquifer in northern Sangamon County and pipe water to the village south of Springfield. Even though Lake Springfield connects to the Chatham village limits, Mayor Tom Gray says this is the best decision for residents. He says as Springfield has consistently raised rates on the water it sells and put limitations on where Chatham can extend service, it's time for his village to go out on its own.
If you don't have water, you can't grow with population. We're really good on maintaining our infrastructure, and without that water, you know, how are we going to afford to do that? It's an investment in the community that we've got to make.
Water decisions made today will be far-reaching. They'll affect generations to come in central Illinois, but towns are walking a tightrope, balancing costs with the need for a sufficient water supply, all the time hoping they don't run out of luck. I'm Sean Crawford.
Our series continues tomorrow with a report on the quality of water in central Illinois. The Supreme Court decided last week that lethal injection passes constitutional muster, specifically finding that Kentucky's process of causing death was not cruel and unusual punishment. The decision is even more detailed than the Illinois lethal injection statute. Commentator Amy Guida explains in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
There's an Illinois appellate court case from about 20 years ago that decides a death penalty issue, something about lethal injection. It's not a ruling about the constitutionality of the death penalty. It doesn't focus a bit on any argument regarding cruel and unusual punishment. Instead, the case is about the public's right to know about the process of lethal injection, the process of the execution of a person found not fit to live among us. Yes, the court ruled, a man who wanted to learn about the drugs involved in an execution in Illinois, the dosage and the rate of administration, could learn at least some of that. It's not clear from the opinion exactly what the state wanted held back, but the court found that the man's questions had to be answered at least in part, and that bureaucratic arguments that the information wasn't yet ready to go public weren't valid. The United States Supreme Court focused on that same sort of information, the process, when it decided the lethal injection case last week, finding that lethal injection is not cruel and unusual punishment. The justices in dissent joined the majority in writing some pretty horrifying stuff, really, like the fact that in some states, someone in the death chamber touches the eyelashes of the condemned when they believe he's sedated, because should his eyelids flutter, he needs more of the sedative or else he'll feel excruciating pain from the chemicals that come next in the process of killing. It's not clear whether that sort of information, the eyelashes test, found its way into the hands of the Illinois man who wanted certain lethal injection information from the state 20 years ago, likely so he could make the same sorts of arguments about cruel and unusual punishment that the Supreme Court found lacking last week. But there's enough detail within the single statute regarding lethal injection in Illinois to answer at least some of those questions. The law is somewhat innocuously execution of sentence. And as of last week, when the Supreme Court upheld Kentucky's lethal injection statute, it probably passes constitutional muster. That's because the Supreme Court had to get into the nitty-gritty of lethal injection in deciding it's constitutional for states to take lives that way. In Illinois, for example, the executioner, that's the precise term in the statute, uses an intravenous administration of a lethal quantity of an ultra-short-acting barbiturate in combination with a chemical paralytic agent and potassium chloride or other equally effective substances sufficient to cause death. In Kentucky, the statute is less specific, but the court noted and upheld the state's specific mix, similar to that used in Illinois, in its opinion. The first drug, the court explained, is a fast-acting barbiturate sedative that induces a deep coma-like unconsciousness, while the second drug inhibits all muscular skeletal movements and paralyzes the diaphragm. The third induces cardiac arrest. Why is this review so important now, after the Supreme Court upheld its constitutionality? Here's what the Illinois Appellate Court wrote in the Freedom of Information Act case from 20 years ago. Information about lethal injection is precisely the type of information that enables people to fulfill their duties of discussing public issues, make informed political judgments, and monitor the government to ensure that it is being conducted in the public interest. And that's true even in a state that's currently under a death penalty moratorium. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois.
Earth and Sky.
Well, they've transformed my life, and I think that they have the ability to transform anybody's life.
That's outdoor adventure journalist Peter Potterfield talking about the wild places of the Earth. His book, Classic Hikes of the World, Potterfield writes, is a tool to help not only athletes, but busy families spend a few nights in the backcountry.
The beautiful thing about hiking is that it can keep you healthy from age 10 to age 88 or 90. As long as you're able to walk around the neighborhood, you're able to do these hikes.
Potterfield talked about a hike with his 10-year-old godson.
So he was pretty young, and we did a 10-mile hike up into the Goat Rocks area of the Cascades, a beautiful place where you look over here and see Mount Rainier, you look over here and you see Mount Adams. So this was an experience the kid has never forgotten, and it made him a lifelong hiker.
There are upsides, Potterfield said, to hiking besides just physical fitness.
With a pack in your feet, you just walk and walk and walk. And there is a spiritual side to that. Psychologically, you feel the wind. You feel the sun on your face. You see the night sky. This has the effect of opening up your mind to things that maybe you weren't open to before. It makes you more of a humble inhabitant of the planet.
That's our show for today, where Earth and Sky are a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programming is made possible by the University of Illinois College of Law, hosting A Debtor World, interdisciplinary academic symposium on debt, focusing on the debt crisis on May 2nd and 3rd in cooperation with the American Bankruptcy Institute. More information is available at www.law.uiuc.edu.
1 minute before 3 o'clock Central Time, you're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director. Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana for the remainder of the afternoon, partly to mostly sunny. Highs ranging from 70 in northeastern Indiana to near 80 in western Illinois. Tonight, clear to partly cloudy. Lows ranging from 50 in eastern Indiana to near 60 in western Illinois. And the outlook for tomorrow in Illinois becoming mostly cloudy with scattered showers and thunderstorms arriving. In Indiana tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny. Highs ranging from 68 in northwestern Illinois to near 80 in far southern Illinois. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, mostly sunny. The high 76. Tonight, partly cloudy. The low 55. Tomorrow, becoming mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and a few thunderstorms developing in the afternoon. The high 76. Up next, it's The World from PRI, coming up on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. www.ucla.edu. It's 3 o'clock Central Time, 4 o'clock in the Eastern Time Zone.